Welcome to Out of the Question, a podcast that looks behind some common questions and uncovers the question behind the question while providing real solutions for biblical world and life view. Your host is Andrea Schwartz, a teacher and mentor and founder of the Chalcedon Teacher Training Institute.
Part of a victorious eschatology is trusting God that there will always be a remnant that will carry on the work to advance the kingdom. Were you to just look at social or legacy media, you might not be that hopeful. However, trust me, you're not looking in the right places. I've had the privilege of teaching young people from homeschooling families for years. Their understanding and willingness to put into action what they have learned is encouraging. But that's not the only place that God is raising up the next generation of Christian men and women for kingdom service. Today, I have two young men with me who attend Virginia Tech University. They call themselves the Kingsmen. When I first encountered them, I was struck by their enthusiastic determination to see the kingdom of God advance. And while they're very aware of obstacles, not unlike Joshua and Caleb, they see beyond the giants in the land. Thanks for joining me today, Gil Roten, originally from Texas, and Camden Whitener, who hails from Virginia.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us. We're really excited.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So I think I'll begin with the designated ringleader, Gil. Share some of your background and how you came to embrace the mission God has for you as a young man, and then we'll hear from Camden.
So again, my name's Gil Roten. I'm a junior here at Virginia Tech. My background is sort of interesting, and it's probably not what a lot of people would expect for somebody that's interested in Christian Reconstruction. My family went to sort of a progressive Methodist church growing up, and I went to a secular private school. Eventually, in high school, I was introduced to a Bible study that my brother was attending, and through some of the faithfulness of his friends, and even through just kind of like YouTube apologists, God was planting seeds in my life and was helping me to grow up in maturity in the faith, which I think includes bringing you up in knowledge. And eventually over that time, I was watching different people. Specifically, I was watching some YouTube apologetics, and one of the guys was Jeff Durbin. And Jeff is amazing. He's done amazing work with street apologetics, but he does a podcast. They have Bonds and You. And through that, I was introduced to different ideas like postmillennialism, theonomy, and I didn't know it at the time, the term, but Christian Reconstruction. And so as time has gone on, I've just continued reading within the Christian Reconstruction material, continued to just meditate on the law of God itself and attempt to be faithful to the covenant and receive the promises of God by faith. And so obviously, if our theology and our knowledge mean anything, then they have implications for the way that we live our life. And so that led me to work on having community around me while I was in college that I could introduce to these ideas and hopefully bring up in what I believe to be a scriptural view of life.
All right. And then somewhere along the line, Camden came into the picture. Camden, you tell us something about you.
I like to say that I was raised by Christians, but there's a lot of ways in which I wasn't raised Christian or in a Christian way. I didn't have the entire background foundation that I needed, that I should have had necessarily growing up. But I found a way to stumble into something good here and there. And I do think I came into college with a good philosophical or principled foundation, coming in for learning, for the kind of theology I was willing to adopt. I had taken a lot of stuff that I had heard, not questioned it growing up, and a lot of it was, I believe, erroneous. And then I come to college. Gil was my freshman roommate. It's a very interesting, funny story how we actually came to be roommates, because we didn't know each other going in, but it wasn't through the random process. We still planned it. Speaks to the providence of God. But I got introduced to these ideas from Gil. From there, I mean, I took it and I ran with it. He got me started, and then I just went on a crazy rampage, consuming all the videos, articles, books, reading, watching, listening, having conversations with Gil, trying to learn as much as I possibly could. And from there, like the way that Gil described kind of the current trajectory, the current, like the where we're at now, it would be the same for me, right? Trying to be faithful, trying to live in all areas of my life according to scripture, submit all of my thoughts to the Lordship of Christ, and continue to learn.
Okay, just for your background, what was your schooling like?
I was public schooled at every level, and the worst of it is public high school. I've talked a lot to people about my new circle, my new people I surround myself now at college. It's a bunch of kids, young people at the church I go to that have never been to public school. So I have to explain what that's like. And it's very bad, and no Christian should be a part of it.
Do you think that when you both came to college, probably had certain expectations, and people will often say, don't go to college because that's where people lose their faith. Did you experience a period where it felt that way?
So I'm Gil. I would say that there was a time my freshman year, I was not walking faithfully in the way that I should have. And honestly, I should have brought it to my elders. I think part of it is just that I wasn't necessarily being discipled, or I didn't have authority over me that could bring me towards, I think, a healthy understanding of repentance, faithfulness, and specifically just like different things that you can bring into your life that can help alleviate or help you to fight different areas that are sinful. It was not a time where I was like questioning whether or not I should be a believer, but certainly I think that the issue for me was not whether or not I would have been at college, but simply just simple faithfulness towards God and being under authority. And during that time, God continued to be kind to me, be long-suffering toward me. It was during that time that I had all of these guys come around me. So I had knowledge, but I didn't have the obedience that I needed in my life.
Okay, Camden, how about you?
I guess I experienced something that's not the normal thing you see, because the normal thing you see is Christians going to college. A lot of them struggle. A lot of them stop going to church. They leave the faith. I pretty much only saw growth being at college. I was never at a point where it was like, because I'm in college now and because of this and all these circumstances that I'm in now, I'm taking steps backwards. I mean, I started to get the things that I needed. Being at a church where I'm surrounded by older men that I'm constantly around and talking with, and they're discipling me and helping me, and having good, strong friends, the strongest I've ever had, and the first being Gil, I like to say that I grew more in like the last 2 years than I did in the first 18 of my life by a mile, not even close. There was a lot of ways which like my daily practice, like I could have been doing better. But when I came into college, it's not like anything got worse. It just continued to get better because I started to get the spiritual food that I needed. And a lot of that was the church that I started going to and that I was a part of, that congregation, just completely different than anything I'd ever been a part of earlier. And I started to see, oh, it really matters. It really changes things. But then also I think that there's a lot of the reason kids fall into that is because they go to college, they find a basic campus ministry. A lot of which campus ministries they're not really helping, and then they kind of check that box and they're like, all right, I'm doing what I'm supposed to do as a Christian at college now, and then they start to fall into things or they start to lose like they start they're not making any progress, they're not growing, and they don't know why because they thought that they were doing everything they needed to do by being a part of a campus ministry. I mean,
I
I
see.
tried that. I got out of that. Me and Gil got out of that pretty quickly, and we started, just like our full involvement is with our local church. We got a part of this congregation. We've got these friends now and these families that we're interacting with. And again, like these older men, this is what we're pouring our time into. I can see the difference, especially like, and you could point to me and be like, you can do it right and it can be helpful towards your faith. College doesn't have to hurt your faith, even though it does to a lot of people.
And I think both of you are testimonies to the sovereignty of God. It's so easy to have a formula. This is what you do with kids. This is where they go to school. Even homeschooling families have kids that turn away from the faith. So I like the way, Gil, you mentioned it as God's kindness, because having a group of people that you can fellowship with, and as a matter of fact, it was through one of the men at your church that I even heard about you guys. And when we had our first conversation, I was amazed. The maturity you guys have exceeds your years. And that's a good thing. That's why I started off by saying it's important that people be hopeful. I didn't know you existed a month ago, and now I know you guys do. And there's two others who are part of your group, the King's Men, that you sort of call yourself, but they couldn't attend today. So tell me a little bit about the atmosphere on campus. I know you've just described for us how you look at the world. Are you colliding regularly on campus with a different worldview than your own?
Most definitely.
This is Gil talking, so I just want to identify who's talking. Okay.
Right. Yeah, no, most definitely. There's different ways in which we are encountering different worldviews on campus. I think that the far majority of college students, even if they are Christians, still have some level of a humanistic tolerance. There is a level of Christian charity that we might have that is good, but I think the humanistic tolerance that is never willing to bring Christianity as a rival worldview to the worldviews around us. At least Christians within those universities are not doing everything that they could. I mean, just like in the day-to-day, you're definitely hearing conversations while you're sitting, eating your food on campus that are not appropriate. That's definitely a regular part of being a Christian at a college. There are also, of course, like the understanding of what it would look like to dress appropriately is not really an important thing on college campuses. In my philosophy class, the different worldviews that are being discussed, certainly we would have some differences. But by and large, the most significant kind of event for us is when we go out and we do evangelism and we talk with students on Fridays. And at that point, we're actually able to have the discussions with students and hear what it is they believe, why they believe it.
Okay, so Camden, I'll ask you. Gil just said you do this on Fridays. Well, makes sense. You guys are going to school, so you probably have to show up at classes and do your assignments. What's the format that you guys have on Fridays in terms of engaging with people?
I mean, it's changed a little bit over the years, but for the most part, since freshman year, we've done it the same way. And we have a sign with a message on it and an invitation to come and talk to us. So one, we want to make it clear that we don't just want you to come and read our little message and keep walking. We're actually inviting conversation. We're standing there so you can walk up and we can have a conversation with you. We've put a lot of things on the sign. Our current favorite is Jesus was sacrificed for sin. Babies shouldn't be. Come talk to us. We like being able to speak out against abortion, especially, you know, to this culture and being especially outspoken about that. We've had signs, the Christian God is the only basis for morality. Come and talk to us. Stuff like that. We're inviting these worldview conversations. It's like Gil said, I mean, you talk about, do we encounter different worldviews? We intentionally do. We go out there looking for it. And a lot of people walk up, they might be Christians and they're encouraging us and we love that. Or they might be Christians, they might have some questions, some genuine questions about our method, and we defend that. But we'll get a lot of, you name it, atheists, Muslims, Hindus, different worldviews. You have just the general college student. They live for themselves. It's this humanistic religion that they wouldn't even use those words to describe it. They know God, but they hate God. And they're living like it. And every time they come up to us, we try to put the conversation in the proper context. We don't attack people. You know, they might say, I'm curious. I want to know what this is all about. What's your thing? Go for it. And we'll stop them and we'll say, well, tell us a bit about yourself first. You know, what's your faith background? What are you in? What have you moved through? Where are you coming from at this? We like to have this conversation with you as a person, not just giving you the script, you know, that's in our heads.
Sure.
And they'll tell us about themselves. We'll take conversations in different directions based on who we're talking to the proper extent, because there's an improper extent, but to the proper extent, we'll meet someone where they're at and we will challenge them. One of the claims that we make very clear with people is you do know the Christian God, the one who made you. You can't escape that knowledge. And we pose the question, does God exist? He does. You know him. Why have you not submitted to him yet? Why do you continue to live in rebellion to God? We'll press people on this, right? When we get to a certain point. With people who are more willing and ready for like the deep philosophical conversations, we'll get into it. They know the terms, they're coming, they're ready. They've got their arguments, they're coming up to us, they're going to duke it out with us. And we're willing to do that and defend our God before them. In terms of the main format, when people come up, we stand on God and his word. We stand on our Christian presuppositions. We are distinctively Christian while we evangelize. We don't set anything aside. and we bring the bold message to everyone that God now commandeth all men everywhere to repent. Acts 17, this is what Paul did. We try to model it as closely as we can after that. But then we also try to do everything with meekness and fear, as Peter says.
Okay, so I just want people to get a sense of what this looks like. Are you outside? Are you in the cafeteria? Did you have to get permission to set up where you set up? Gil, why don't you take that question?
Yeah, we stand outside. We're at like the kind of like an intersection on campus, really close to the bus loops. They just built a dining hall. I think they finished it last year or
A lot of foot
something.
traffic in
So
there,
there's a
yeah.
lot of, yeah, there's a lot of foot traffic. And so we stand out there. We have a sign. Usually there's somewhere between 3 to sometimes 6, sometimes more, because we have people from church that come and we have conversations with people. We do not get permission from the school to do it. We actually had an encounter last year. It was actually this sign. We brought this sign back for the first time since we did it last year. And last year there were just students that were upset. I think that they were previously Palestine protesters the previous year, and they had a lot of them had been arrested. And so we had some students come who were just upset about the sign in general because it was an anti-abortion sign. And so they called the cops on us several times. The cops came. Most of the time they had been kind towards us. Well, they were always kind towards us to an extent. But eventually they brought the dean, and they actually said, unless you leave, you'll be arrested. And so we had just been going through Daniel, and we had a lot of courage. And so, yeah, we stood and we said, you'd have to arrest us because we don't believe that Paul registered to stand out to go to the synagogue. We don't believe that Paul registered with the school or with his, in his case, with the state, so that he could go to the marketplace and speak about Jesus. So if students can go on campus and talk about math, if they can go on campus and talk about what they did that weekend, then we should be able to go on campus and talk about our faith with students.
Didn't
Okay.
arrest us.
They didn't in the end. They did not arrest us,
You know,
so.
so you're not jailbirds. Oh, well. So, Camden, sometimes you said there's four, six people from your church. Do you then break off into one-on-ones with people because they want you start a conversation? How long can these conversations go? And it doesn't sound like, I mean, in one sense, you're confrontational because you're confronting truth, but it doesn't sound like you're trying to be belligerent with people.
Right. We will do that, but we break off. So there might be like the four of us go out there to start, like we just got out there, and the first person walks up. Somebody will take that conversation and start to go with it. And then if somebody else walks up, somebody will, one of us will break off and go ask them, hey, what's up? You want to talk about this? If we could be, we would all four be in different conversations, right? If we had that many people interested, we'd love to have as many people as possible interested. If we're actually all talking and there's people that are waiting, that's a bad feeling for us. But we don't want people to be like standing there and they want to talk and maybe they walk away. So we break off as much as possible. These conversations, most of them go for, at least 30 minutes, 20 to
Wow.
30 minutes. We've had conversations that go longer for like an hour or more. These can be really personal conversations. We're working through something with somebody. And we're making up, we're if we're going for like an hour, 2 hours, a lot of the times we're making a lot of progress with them and getting to different things. Most of the conversations, very cordial conversations. People like what we do. They'll say, hey, thank you for this. And like, we enjoy this. We have a lot of people who come back repeatedly. So maybe they'll come and they'll say, we'll make it, they'll be like, I gotta go now, but that was a good point. They come back, they've looked into something, they want to keep talking. We have people that come continually just to see us. It's really, really good. We've built some like some stronger relationships with people. And then sometimes, very few and far between, we'll get the nasties. We'll get the people who yell at us, maybe. We haven't had something like that like recently at all. And when we did have it in the past, it was just a handful of times where we'd have somebody who was just angry and yelling and getting up in our faces. Most of the time, it's cordial conversations. People come up and they're there to stay for, more than just a couple minutes. That's why we get so pumped to go out there, because we know that we get really productive conversations going on. And it's not just little 1 minute interactions where somebody mad at us and then we say something and then they storm off. We get really good stuff going on out there.
Wow, that's great. Do you hand anything out, Gil, when so that they have something to take with them?
Most of the time, what happens is a lot of the people that come now, because I think there's a certain interest that a person might have that would lead them to go and talk to us. So a lot of the people that come and talk to us are meeting with us regularly, and we invite them to our church. We invite them to go to what we call Theology Tuesday, which is where we just meet at Panera and talk theology. So we try to bring them to meet us these different places where we can continue the conversations. And there's times where, like, we'll exchange a phone number so that we can send them the address and maybe meet up and have a further conversation. But a lot of the times, the only kind of literature that we'll hang out, there's a time where somebody is having a conversation for such a long time, and then they'll say, "Hey, do you have a Bible?" And a lot of the times, one of the guys will just hand over their personal Bible,
Oh,
and then
wow.
somebody has a Bible, and then we get another one.
So I know that not only you two, but the other two, you're not all studying the same thing. You all came to Virginia Tech for a particular thing you were going to study, and you're continuing to study it. So I guess you're pretty well known on the campus. Do you run into faculty, professors, administrative people when you're out there? And how does this affect how your professors or the teachers look at you? Because I can't imagine that if you've been doing it for as long as you have, you're not known.
Well, Camden speaking, we don't know. We don't get to see the full like extent of our reach. There's definitely people who see us and they never talk to us. And there's definitely people who see us walking to class and who see us in class and at the dining hall or something like that. They know us from the sign where they've seen us standing out there. They don't come up and talk to us. So we don't get to really know the full extent of it. I don't know which of my professors know that I do it or not. But I don't see any bias, which is good. None of the professors are like persecuting us or anything like that with grades or with like harsh words or anything like that. I've seen some of my professors out. Like I was out, I think a year or two ago, I was out there. I saw one of my professors walking by and I shouted at him, "Hey, Professor so and so." And we certainly don't try to hide anything. Gil has seen professors of his walking by before. We don't really get the like, we're going to class or we're anything like that. Somebody's like, "Hey, you're the guys from the sign." We don't get a lot of that as much. I mean, we would love to have that, and like that could start an evangelistic conversation. We do definitely trust the fact that we're known, that like people know that this happens. Because people come up to us and they say, "Hey, I've seen this before," or "I've heard a friend talk about you guys before this many times, and I just couldn't walk by again." And they come up like, "Because I've seen you repeatedly, same spot, same day, same time, I can count on you to be out here. I came out here today knowing where you guys were going to be, counting on it, because this time I wanted to talk to you." And that we actually enjoy that. We're like, "Okay, so the consistency does matter. People notice it. We're known for that. And people know where they can find us." And so somebody does, their heart gets pricked and they want to come out. That's good that they can count on us being out there. We enjoy that.
That's great. Just because a lot of people in college find themselves in their class situations having to confront the worldview of their professors, which do not match their own, how have you dealt with having to stay true to your conviction, maybe in the midst of a class where you know the bias and the worldview is different? Camden, let's start with you.
Freshman year, I took a philosophy class and I enjoyed it. It was the only one I took because I'm not a philosophy major. But in that class, we're going through issues, and I love the format of the class. It's like a conversational thing. He goes off on it. He starts a topic, and it's like we're just going back and forth with him and with each other, and we're throwing questions out there, giving answers. And I would speak up a lot, and I would give I'm giving answers from the Christian worldview, openly Christian, not afraid of that. My boldness comes from my confidence in the promises of God, that He's going to bless me, and that if I am not shy in front of men, then He's going to bless that. And so I don't worry about that. But I didn't get persecuted in any way for that, which is nice. I have certainly felt at times like a pressure that is trying to be created. Like there's a professor that's trying to make this that kind of environment where you're pressured to think a certain way. But I personally have always had more fun not giving into that. It's a lot more fun to be like, "No, I'm not going to give into that. I'm going to say the thing that nobody else is saying." I enjoy that kind of stuff, even though like we all should do that. It's an ought. I also think it's a lot of fun,
Okay,
so
okay.
that's a motivation for me. But I've had professors, they're open about their politics and all that stuff. They're open. You can tell how much they don't like, how much they hate God. And I've never had to change what people think I believe to try and get a good grade or anything like that.
I see.
I've never
Okay.
written an essay or a discussion post a certain way because I'm afraid. I think there's maybe colleges where it's worse, but for me, Virginia Tech has been a place where there's not too much like heavy classroom persecution and like if you're a Christian, you better be quiet about it type of thing.
Gil, as you talk about your experience, I wonder how many people show up at your table saying, I wish I had a good response in my classes because I don't know how to do anything besides be quiet. Because a lot of times, if you speak out, you may not have a bunch of people going, yeah, I believe that too, because maybe they're grade conscious or they don't want to stand out. Tell me a little bit about what you've encountered in some of your classes.
Yeah, I think that part of the difference for Camden and I is that we're both, so he's a stat major, I'm accounting. And so how often are our questions of ethics coming up in accounting? Sometimes it's usually pretty rare and it's almost never a class discussion. So pretty much the only times that we've gotten a chance to talk about ethics, talk about faith within the classroom setting itself would be in philosophy classes. So I'm a philosophy major. That helps that I do have some opportunities to talk about it. And I have noticed I'm in metaphysics right now. In metaphysics, we do end up having questions that I try every time to go in front of the class, during class, and bring it back to why I believe that the Christian God and the Christian worldview can answer these questions and maybe why other worldviews cannot. I think there are students that definitely, whether they would say this or not, appreciate the fact that the Christian worldview does have answers to these questions that other worldviews just don't, or that they're left without knowing whether or not they're in the matrix or a brain in the vat or that kind of thing. But I've also noticed all of the Christians now in the class, there's, I think, three of us, maybe four of us, we all sort of sit in the front row because we like the fact that we're all trying to be faithful in this setting. Other than that, as far as students in the classroom, I think that there are a lot of students, or like students that come up to us at the sign that talk about what they have in the classroom. Most of the Christians, unfortunately, we wish that more Christians would come to us and talk to us and want to talk to us about what we're doing or encourage us. A lot of them give us a thumbs up and say, I love what you're doing, and then keep walking. And that's, you know, that's okay. You know, we would definitely appreciate to have longer conversations with them. But a lot of the students that come up to us are students that either know that they're lost and say, hey, I'm lost, my life is crazy. And that's sort of a handful. But then a lot of the students are just looking to have either an intellectual conversation because they haven't felt like Christianity is intellectual, that only, you know, the only intellectuals that exist are atheists. But so I think that's more of the need that we're filling through our science.
I often tell students that I teach, think of the question you don't want someone to ask you. And that's the question you have to answer for yourself, because a lot of the real estate that has to be conquered is between our ears. So you made the statement, Gil, that a lot of people think that there is no intellectual depth to Christianity. I know you've both been exposed to Dr. R.J. Rushdoony's writings. And to be very honest, most people will say, well, young people are just not interested in that. That's just beyond them. Tell me a little bit, and this will be a question for each of you, what you gained from reading a man who has been dead 24 years and was writing primarily at times that you guys weren't even born yet.
I mean, for me, Camden.
This is Camden talking. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I can tell that like Rushdoony and then the other men in the same sphere, that they have something that I think is so rare that I don't see a lot because I'm living at a different time. I don't see a lot of it, almost any of it, like face to face. It's not very often I meet a man that reminds me of the man that I can tell that the kind of men that I can tell these men were just from reading their works, because it's a lot of the intellectual stuff and I'm learning a lot. And I've read a lot of Bahnsen, Van Til, Rushdoony. It is the boldness that they have. And I think specifically, like, because I've read the most and listened to the most Bahnsen, it's like I could speak to it more with him. But the boldness that he had was just something that, like, when I was first getting introduced to this stuff, it was so refreshing to see it. And so the main thing with these men is just that the way that they applied themselves and that they put the work in to be scholars and to study this stuff more than anyone else has the time to, and to put out these articulate works so that I can read it and learn and gain and benefit as somebody who doesn't have the kind of time or who hasn't studied as much, making those ideas, making the knowledge, the information, the ideas accessible to me. And that's the kind of thing that I know that they were trying to do, especially the guys who took up, Van Til's work and tried. So Rushdoony wrote a book with a subtitle, An Analysis of the Philosophy of Cornelius Van Til. And Greg Bahnsen wrote a book with Van Til's name in the title, Van Til's Apologetic. They're trying to make his kind of work accessible to everyone, make it more understandable, more digestible. I think everybody should have the hunger and the thirst for knowledge, and specifically in the theological realm, and knowing more about God and His Word. We should all have that. But for the guys who do have that, like me and Gil and Gunnar and Josh, the other two Kingsmen, something that we can go and we can feed on then, something that can actually fill that desire, that thirst and that hunger, something that is that you got to chew on and work through because it's really above me, right? Like I can't fully
Sure.
grasp this. These men were so intelligent. But it's all of those things, and I can tell the kind of men that they were from not only testimony of other people talking about them, and not only hearing like watching a lecture or video, but reading the books, and you can see their motives and why they were doing it, their drive, their zeal for God.
You want to add anything to that, Gil?
Yeah, if I understand the question correctly, the question is, what would incentivize young guys specifically to learn or to read some of these older men, specifically like Rushdoony?
Right, that's my question. Because a lot of people would think that's not what young people are interested in.
What I think was true when Rushdoony was writing, and is definitely true right now, is that people are looking for answers. People are looking for answers to the questions that they have. And Christians are looking, so we're saved. And then the question is, what now? What do we do now that we're saved? Do we wait? Do we just kind of do the minimal Christian tasks and focus inwardly? Or is there work to be done? And I think that what Rushdoony hit, and I think that the sort of questions that he could answer are those questions of what now? So in Ecclesiastes, you see that the whole duty of man is to fear God and to keep his commandments. And you see Jesus, for example, he talks about seeking first the kingdom of God. And you say, okay, so we have this one thing, the entire duty of man is fearing God and keeping his commandments. And this other thing that Jesus is talking about, the thing we have to seek first is the kingdom of God. And so we have two really important questions then. What are his commandments all about? What does that really mean? And what is this kingdom that we're supposed to be seeking? And so I think that a lot of the writing of Christian Reconstruction is answering those two questions. What exactly is the kingdom? What is the work of the kingdom? And what does it mean that the law is important for us and that we're supposed to keep his commandments? I think those two questions are questions that have been left unanswered in a lot of churches, and a lot of young people are looking at that and kind of asking, well, what do these things mean? And so to have present work and to have simply work that is biblical that we can read, understand, and live out, I don't know why any generation that is faithful would not look for something like that.
So when we originally were meeting each other, you and Josh wasn't there, but Gunnar was there, and we were talking, and you were very eager to know what you could do to help a ministry like Chalcedon. And it's not that there aren't things to do, but if you remember, I told you guys are already doing things that would constitute as ministry because you are going beyond what you have to do by standards of, you go to school, you do your studies, and then you graduate. But you have made a priority in reaching people, and because you and your friends have such a hunger and thirst for this, I think that it's so obvious that people who also have a hunger and thirst are like, these guys might not know everything, but they look like they know something and that they're eager to share it. So, do you find that as you're making plans for the future, that whatever you end up doing that, supports you and a wife and family, that this will always remain a mainstay of what your focus will be on?
I'm Gil. When Joseph died, the Pharaoh that came up after him did not know if Joseph. Obviously, Israel was treated a different way when Joseph was alive versus in that later generation. And I think the same thing could be true for Christian Reconstruction, at least just for these generations right now, if there were not young men willing to do the work. What I'm getting at there is that I remember when I first started learning about Christian Reconstruction and I realized the vast amount of books and articles and there were all of these things to sift through. And I thought, well, surely there are people out there that are knowledgeable and that know what these works are about and that can tell you about them and that can promote the ideas that were put forward in those works. But that's not necessarily true for our current generation, that there are people that have done the work to read through that material and to bring it to the nations and to bring it to people, to bring it to the church. And so Christian Reconstruction is inevitable because it's rooted in the promises of God concerning the world, concerning God's law, and that it will go forth to the nations. But the question is, do I want the work of Christian Reconstruction to fall towards my grandchildren's grandchildren for them to try to bring back this work? And the answer should be no. So if there's going to be somebody who will continue bringing these ideas forward and will continue to bring them to the church, we shouldn't leave it to another person. We shouldn't leave it to another generation. We should take the responsibility ourselves and do everything that we can to promote God's kingdom and the work of his kingdom. And so I think, yeah, that is at the center of what we are looking at for our future and planning everything around those things.
How about you, Camden?
Gil mentioned that Christian Reconstruction is inevitable. We believe God has promised certain things, but that doesn't make us apathetic. It's actually what motivates us. It's the fact that God has promised this. And so if we believe in this work, if we believe in this change, in the way in transforming the world in this way, we can't say that we want that and then say that we're not going to be a part of it, though. We're not going to be a part of bringing it about. That would be completely hypocritical and contradictory. We care about bringing about what God has promised in the world. We know where that starts. We know where we're at now. We know where that has to start and the specific areas where progress needs to be made. And we have an idea of how it can look. And so we need to be doing that. And it's always going to be, like you said, it's always going to be a focus and a main thing. It is because especially now, like, we need to carry the momentum that is there from, you know, from the Reconstructionists, Greg Bahnsen, RJ Rushdoony, Gary North, and so on. We need to carry that momentum. We could say it's inevitable. It's going to happen. So why do we need to worry about it? Beyond that being hypocritical and just like a dumb thing to say, we're pushing things off. This work still has to be done by people. God is going to accomplish this in the world, but if not through an unfaithful, he's not through an unfaithful generation. Caleb is faithful. Everybody else is not. He says, I'm going to let you all die off. And Caleb and his family and his generations are going to inherit the land. Not you though. Not you. You don't believe in what I said. No, you don't believe in my promises. You don't have faith in me when I told you. So you're not going to see this then, right? I'm going to do it. But it's going to be after you. And it's not going to be because I'm going to do it without people. I'm just going to do it with different people, a later generation. We're not giving up for the progress that we can make now. Our fire is going to remain, Lord willing, forever because it's founded upon something that doesn't change. And that's the promises of God. If that's our drive, if that's our motor, and that's the reason we do it, then we'll never stop doing it.
Exactly. And too often in our society, people think that we need a celebrity to be at the head of a movement. And the fact remains that Christian Reconstruction has always been a grassroots movement. And the people who latched onto it, they didn't wait for someone to tell them, oh, you're excellent, you should do this. They did it because they couldn't do anything else. And I believe that we don't have to be persuasive when we see people particularly. What we have to do is be a faithful witness. And I think that you guys are contagious, and I love it. Now, I did ask you when we talked before, do you bring speakers in to go beyond the conversations that you have? And then also, have you connected with other people at other universities who have heard about you and say, hey, we'd like to do something like this.
So when you mean speakers, do you mean like people that can talk to us, like sort of pastors or other people that we can bring into like
yeah,
a
and then to
event?
Speak to the other people who you've brought alongside you, and they can see that this isn't just these four guys, that there actually are people who hold to that. So have you done events, I guess my question is?
No, we haven't done events. We have basically our entire Sunday is with our church, because we have church in the morning on Sundays, church in the evening, and usually people spend time after church in the evening. And oftentimes we're invited for lunches in the middle of the day. We have Theology Tuesday at Panera, which is wonderful. And a lot of times that's where students come and we can have conversations with people even within our church who might be like, I don't know why you believe these things. And so we can duke it out in a way that's friendly and constructive.
The event that we do mainly is the Theology Tuesday. The guy from our church who hosts that, he's been a theology professor before. He has a PhD. He knows a lot. He's read a lot. He's very smart. I would call him a theologian, written books. He's sort of like an expert speaker that we get to talk to and we get to go at it or pick his brain, and other people we invite them to this and they can be a part of that as well.
Well, it sounds like your Tuesdays are people find you on Fridays, you invite them to Tuesdays, and then, of course, you probably have to do your schoolwork and things like that.
Right.
One of the things I think people forget is that R.J. Rush Dooney, Greg Bahnsen, you'll read their books. They're not here anymore. So I call it like the next tier down. People who understand it, digest it, then speaks to the generation on things that they'll understand and relate to. When Rush Dooney was writing, and I say writing, he didn't use a typewriter, he used a fountain pen. I don't think he ever learned how to use a computer. The fountain pen isn't going to replace the computer anytime soon, but there are all sorts of questions that are going to come up. So how do you apply Christian Reconstruction to artificial intelligence? How do you look at that? How do you deal with the fact that so many people have led sinful lives that have consequences, and how does that get undone? Because you are the age you are and you have the vitality that you do, I, for one, am extremely encouraged, because you will be able to reach a generation that, yeah, I might have some influence with, but it's not going to be the same. And so I'm encouraged by the fact that you're so serious, and I don't mean not having a good time while you do it, but serious about this mission, that I think you're going to inspire some people in the process, maybe some older folk who are like, I thought there was no hope here, but listen to these two guys, and they're extremely hopeful. So I think that's really a good thing. The best part about both of you, and I imagine the other two, is that you don't think you know it all. You know there's a lot more that you have to learn, and you are devoting as much time to sharing what you have to learning more of what will equip you. So before we go, what are your plans for the future other than what you've just laid out? I mean, those are your basic plans. Gil, we'll start with you. What's your hope, or what's your intent? Because that could change, I suppose, when you graduate.
Well, first thing, hopefully I'll be getting married very quickly after I graduate. So I'm sure the girl is going to watch this. So I can't share too much.
I hope you've already proposed, or this is it, huh? You're proposing right now.
We have a wedding venue, because wedding venues are like really hard. You have to request them really far in advance now.
Okay, so this won't be a surprise to her.
No.
Okay,
this won't be a surprise. This won't be a surprise. But yeah, no. So, I mean, hopefully I get married. I think that's an important, like a lot of Christian Reconstruction, what is it through? Well, it's through the means that God has given us. And one of the biggest means is being fruitful, multiplying, discipling our children, teaching them the law of God, teaching them the promises of God and the works that he's done for his people. That's important. I should be starting as an accountant. I plan to do accounting work. And then hopefully at some point we want to maybe go into ministry and start a church if that's possible in the future, or just be present with a church that is already doing the work and that we can assist in and work with them. And then I enjoy writing. I think that it's interesting because David was meditating on the law of God day and night. And I think the church for a long time has not continued that practice. And so I'm on Theonomy Q&A on Facebook, and we're constantly asking questions, picking the brain of men who have thought about this for decades. And what you realize is even Bahnsen in No Other Standard has a footnote where he has an unsettled question. And so there's still questions that are worth exploring more. And a lot of them will say in a chapter, this isn't the final word on this. This is the first word. And so we want to continue thinking about those things. If there's something worthy of a book, then we may write a book. If there's something to have a podcast about and have conversations with people about, we want to do that. But we want to keep up both the intellectual side and the practical side.
All right. How about you, Camden?
I hope to get out of college, find a job. I've already thought about a good career path to take. And I think I'm trying to set up myself well for that so I can, you know, transition very smoothly, go into that. I'll be trying to find a wife so I can start a family and be faithful in the family realm. I don't know when that's going to happen, but I hope to be ready at every point. I'm certainly not pushing that off. Being faithful with my family that I can hopefully start one day, Lord willing. And then to like all the things Gil said, and the main focus, I think, and this is the way I would put it, is we're trying to build something tangible. So we're trying to make Christian Reconstruction something that you can look at and see and say, that's what it is. You could point to a place on the map and say, that's where they are. You could stumble upon a book, become convinced or introduced to these ideas, and then be like, well, how do I grow this? And how do I put my family in a place where we can, you know, make this transition? You can point to this place on the map. We go there. That's where they are. That's where the Christian Reconstruction movement is happening. We want to give our kids a place. We don't want to only give them a foundation to build on with our work, but a place to build it in. And then their kids, and then their kids. And, you know, we want to be faithful to Deuteronomy 6, how you teach your kids the law of God. That's the foundation for education. And so we want to see the generational progress and effects with being faithful with our kids. And then hopefully they will, right? That's the idea. But a lot of that, I think, is trying to build something that people can grab onto, a place that people can move to. If that requires starting a Reconstructionist theonomic church somewhere, we would not shy away from doing that.
You're planning, even though you may go in different directions and, you know, you're from different places, that you'll maintain this network that you have with the other fellows and people that you're working with. You're not all necessarily planning on ending up in the same longitude and latitude, but you will stay connected and keep that mission and that thrust going.
Right. But at the very least, we would love to also end up in the same area. I mean, that would be like the ideal. We're not, you know, holding our breath for everything to fall into place exactly how we can, but we also are, you know, shooting for something like that.
Okay. Well, before we go, first of all, thanks for spending time. It's in the middle of your school week, so I appreciate that you have done this. You call yourself the King's Men, and the place you now all live together is the King's House. Is that just an internal thing, or do people on the outside also know that that's how you refer to yourself and where you live?
Initially, we were looking to just build ministry on campus, and we just had to have a name. And so I don't know exactly how it came about, but eventually it was the King's Men, because since we're post-mill, we would take seriously the kingship of Christ. And we just thought, well, this is kind of makes sense. We're a bunch of men, and we're men that hope to serve the king. And so we're the King's Men. And then people at church just started calling us the King's Men. And then people started making group chats when they're with us, like the King's Company. And then it just became this kind of thing.
How would people get in touch with you if they wanted to? Even if they're not young people listening, which I hope they do, but they're parents and grandparents, and they're saying, oh, I like these young men. I want my kids to have exposure to that. How might they reach you?
At least for me, I would say one of the best ways to reach me would be on Facebook. I'm Gil Roten on Facebook, and you can message me, and I would love to message anyone who'd be interested.
I mean, I have Facebook. That's the social media I have. And so somebody could, you know, again, find me there. You could also find Gil's podcast on Spotify or YouTube. And he recently brought me on. So we both do that together a little bit. But it's, you know, you can find the Sola Lex Dei podcast. If you look for that, you could interact with, you know, the work in that way.
All right. That's great. Like I said, guys, I'm very encouraged. And I hope that King's Men grows. And I think it will, because like I said, I think your enthusiasm and your depth of understanding is contagious. So really what it means to go viral, That's what I hope happens in terms of how you inspire other people to see the hardest part is getting started. Keeping going then becomes something of, it just sort of propels itself. Listeners, outofthequestionpodcast@gmail.com is how you reach us. And if you have questions and you forgot any of their names or whatever, email me and I'll pass it along. Thanks, guys.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to Out of the Question. For more information on this and other topics, please visit calcedon.edu.